Accession number 13856, reel 5.
Commander here, reel 5.
Reel 5. Brace myself. Is it going round?
Yes.
Right, well, Nelson, we got to Nelson. I was, amongst many others, the ship was overcrowded. I think there were about 20 of us sleeping in the ship's chapel on the floor. Well, it's deck. We were pretty stunned after being sunk, so we didn't have much joy. We just lay there sleeping. I think the first time we'd had more than 48 hours sleep non-stop. So we arrived back in Liverpool, and we all thought we'd get 3 weeks survivor's leave. Even the lowest seamen used to get an issue of trousers, jerseys and sweaters, and we all had what we were torpedoed in, nothing else. So we neither got a refit of clothes, nor 3 weeks' leave. 10 days later, I was back on the job again. I remember having 10 days. I stayed in Brown's Hotel in London, thinking I was going to have 3 weeks' real fun. And all they did was give me a DSC and send me back to work again. And on the somewhere in the, I got back to England in the about December 3 or 4, and on the 14th I was back at Yeovilton doing an instructional job in Hurricane 759 Squadron at Yeovilton, and I stood that for about a month, and then I got given a squadron, the first squadron I was given, 761 Squadron, that's right, Yeovilton. My job was in Fulmers to train the boys in deck landing and night flying. I did that for 6 months. That was quite fun. Most of my time spent test flying, because there wasn't much else to do. And it wasn't until the end, about the middle of 1942, that things started moving, and then I was appointed to 892 or something.
809?
No. Before that, I mean, I was sent to a seafire squadron, the first one, and that didn't last more than about a fortnight, having done a Rolls-Royce course at some Derby and one or two other silly things. I was then shunted from that squadron, which hadn't hardly formed, to 809 to form at St. Mirren with Fulmers. That's right. And that's when we got onto the Army Co-op business. So what, obviously, although I didn't know it at the time, what they were after was the Army Cooperation. Of course, in those days, there was a wing of the Royal Air Force called Army Cooperation Squadrons, well, like the Fleet Air Arms, you know, the Army Co-op business. They had things like Lysanders that kept on getting shot down, you remember, and then the Battle of France. Those are the good old dogs. So we started, we were sent to Sawbridgeworth, which is in Essex, and to train with a Mustang squadron. There we were flying Fulmers. It made us feel very cheap. There were the RAF light blue friends. Very Peter Riddle, what a lovely man, CO, flying these Mustangs. Well, a Mustang was twice as fast as and twice the range of a Fulmer. I mean, it was a bit mean. So we were battling around, pretending we were some use, but we weren't really much use. So we trained in the art of low-level navigation and all that sort of thing, and reconnaissance, how to recognize tanks on the ground or soldiers of the double. It was all rather basic. So after that, we got sent up north to embark in HMS Victorious, and that was a few days. We had about a fortnight up there doing some exercises on landing on remote parts of the Isle of Arran and all sorts of exercises. And then we realized that the ship anchored at the tail of the bank in the Clyde, the whole place was filling up with American merchant ships. I'd never seen so many. The whole place was absolutely chock-a-block of them. What's going on, we said. Of course, we were supposed not to know, all top secret. And we knew we were in for an operation, but we didn't know where, and we hadn't got any proper frequencies, and the RAF kept on saying, it'll all be all right in the end, that sort of thing. Don't you worry, old boy. But we didn't know. We had no allocated frequencies to contact the army. And the army didn't know. So I, with Charles Koch, who was the senior O of operations officer of Victorious, and I went aboard one of the American ships. We could get no change out of the headquarters ship, Bololo. Nobody wanted to know us. There was a senior RAF officer who made these rather cryptic remarks about, don't you worry, old boy business. So we went aboard an American ship. I must say it was quite amusing. We went at about 6 o'clock. We thought the Yanks might be thirsty. So we went at 6 o'clock, thinking they would be having a snort. But my God, tight-lipped lot. They'd just gone straight from America. They hadn't gone ashore. They were still in their ships. And they treated us all as though we were foreign agents or something. So we eventually got admitted to the ship. It took quite a struggle to get on board, saying that we weren't spies and not going to blow them up. And we discussed our problem about, did we have any communication with their headquarters, with our radios, you see, and our aircraft. So we got absolutely no change out of that. So we went to war in the landings in North Africa, Torch, without any sensible, realistic arrangements for communication. So even if we had spotted thousands of panzer divisions all pounding down the track, we'd have had no means of communication other than they had in the First World War, with little bags with which you put your message and had streamers on it. So you threw it out of the airplane over the top of the troops. I mean, literally, that's all we had as communication, except with our own ship, which, of course, was miles off, had no communication with headquarters. It was a really left-footed exercise. However, I've got a lot of interesting photographs taken by my friend Jock Fraser, who only died last week, which is rather sad. And landing was completely unopposed. The weather wasn't all that good. A lot of the landing craft got sort of wrecked. I have a picture of a lot of the doughboys. It was all American landings at Algiers, all covered by our sort of aircraft and so on, all cooking eggs and bacon on the shore, half their landing craft sort of sideways on. Also, he took a picture of, we landed at about dawn, I suppose that was about 7 o'clock, their local time. And after we finished our reconnaissance, discovered there was no hostile movements anywhere within 100 miles in any direction. We flew back over the suburbs of Algiers, and Jock took a lovely picture of a French couple playing tennis. And the clock in the background shows it's 9:30. Or 9:20. And I thought, well, it just shows what an impact a sudden landing of 100,000 men has upon the French sang-froid, you might say. It was a delightful picture. So that was the end of Torch. We did land at Maison Blanche. We had a lot of that awful eau de cheval they have, which they call wine, Algerian wine. You may have heard of it.
Yes.
And Anthony Kimmins was there, who was a very famous broadcaster of the BBC. And we all got very, very tight drinking this stuff. And then we were invaded by the Americans, who had never known anything except rounding up steers, as far as I can make out. all driving around like crazy with jeeps and huge great guns and tied to the back of them, wondering, where do we go now, bud? Business. So we spent the whole of our time trying to direct them where we would like the enemy to sight their anti-aircraft guns to protect the airfield of Maison Blanche. So having put the angst straight, we then went back and drank some more eau de cheval until we finally landed back on board and shoved off. You remember, it was a fiasco of Dahlin who held out. Well, finally, well, we had a bit of opposition. The albacores that we had on board went and bombed a few harbor installations, but otherwise there was no trouble. The big excitement was when it was all over, and the mayor and all his mob were all lined up on the jetty, and Belola, which was a converted merchant ship, which is our headquarters ship, bristling with aerials and communications and brass hats and toffs and maps and things, came in alongside while the commander-in-chief was to step ashore, go down the gangway, to be kissed by the French mayor and the garden band and all the chasseurs alpine, all that lovely stuff the French are crazy about. They're all lined up in red carpets. In comes Belola, at a fair clip, I may say, like a destroyer. I suppose she must have been about 5 knots. And coming alongside and going whizzing past the mayor and the guard of band and still going on, making it, coming to a grinding halt about 200 yards further on. Fortunately, there was a mud bank before he got to the harbour wall. The bows rose up and stopped. The French thought, well, this was tremendous. They all cheered and clapped, and everybody, and all the band picked up the instruments and ran like riggers and took the carpet with them, put it down in the new landing stage. What had happened is that the captain of the ship had rung down for a slow astern, but the engine room telegraph had snapped. The wire had broken. So, of course, they were still going slow ahead all the way onto this mud bank. There's the picture of... And Fraser took his lovely picture of Belola with her bows right, almost embedded in the concrete wall at the far end. Well, it shows Sir Fred Carnot, element of war. Well, that was the end of Torch. One of the good things about Torch was getting back to England, which I was back there about 10 days later, bearing the fruits of the Mediterranean. And I may tell you that it may be a secret, but not well known, that the price, there was no price actually put on a lemon. And if you had a bunch of bananas, yours was heaven and all the women in it. I can tell you, it's the most amazing thing that fruit-starved Britain in 1942, the mention of a lemon would cause a complete change of attitude by almost any of the fair sex. So you can see that all the jolly lads like man, myself, packed our kit bags full of lemons and oranges and bananas and things like that. Very exciting. It was just an indication of chaps like us who've been insulated from the privations that has been going on in England with low rations. On our rare returns to England, when we've been fed so well, no blackouts and lots of the ordinary decent things of life, to see with what enthusiasm they greeted the oranges and lemons, not so much their menfolk. Anyway, that was the end of Torch. What happened after Torch? That was November 42, wasn't it?
Yes.
You went to
4th Squadron.
Oh, yes. Then we had a bit of a bust on. We went on. They thought there might be some more, so we were sent up to York, part of the country. And we were based at 4th Squadron up at York. We had fun up there. We were then really used to train the emerging D-Day landing army in the arts of being molested by aircraft. So... This is when we was Jock Fraser, and we had great fun timing the time of it took when you lit a thunder flash before it blew up. And we worked, it was about 9 seconds. And then we worked out the time of flight of a lit thunder flash from the time of discharge from the aircraft to the time of burst at 50 feet. So we were flying at say, 50 feet, and we wanted to burst at 10 feet. So we worked out how long it took to drop those 30 feet so as to achieve air burst. Well, we got it pretty well. Poor old Jock Fraser had to light the things, you see. And then I said, now when you've lit the thing and it's fizzing nicely, you must count four. And if you're brave, you'll count five and then throw it over the side. And it was amazing. But, you know, the troops always look up when they see an aeroplane and say, cool, one of ours or something like that. And their moonlight faces reveals their position. But after we did the airburst, they stopped doing this goofing. They didn't care to have a bit of thunder flashes in their faces. Well, we had a lot of fun. In the end, of course, we
when
got...
When you say we, are you still with...
809.
Squadron?
Yes, when I say we, I'm talking about Jock Fraser and myself. Of course, I had six other aircraft, or five other aircraft, all part of the same gang. They're all doing the same sort of thing. I was just the joker at the top. And finally, we did a reconnaissance of a thing. We were told there were enemy in some wood, you see. So we found the enemy. There was tanks in this wood. So I used to fire signals cartridge illuminating that balls of magnesium came out, you know, the sort of flares they used in World War I. And when this thing flare, a burning ball of magnesium bounced off the turret of a tank and into the wood. Well, we thought that teaches them something, you see. You think they hadn't camouflaged themselves. We were pretty pleased with ourselves, and we landed back at base. We found all hell let loose. Apparently, nobody had told us, but the tanks were hiding in a wood, and the wood was concealing one of the major ammunition dumps of the northern parts of the counties. And, of course, they had a relatively serious incident of fire. So we were quietly dissuaded from further pyrotechnical displays. However, that all came to an end. And what happened next?
Did you have something to do with the ATA transport? Air transport auxiliary?
Oh, that was part of the frolic, yes. I used to ferry... The air transport auxiliary. My home at that stage, my parents lived in Cookham. And Wickham? No, not High Wickham. I'm trying to think of the airfield that the Royal Aircraft use. Doesn't matter. Anyway, it's near Maidenhead.
White Waltham.
White Waltham, yes. White Waltham. I used to use White Waltham a lot because I landed at White Waltham, parked my aircraft, and hitch a cab to go to Cookham. It was no great distance. So I used to give the ATA bits of whiz rounds. I used to do some quite extraordinary cross country. I used to put two girls in the back of a Fulmer. It was great fun. I'd fly them around half the southern counties of England. Because they got a pretty dull life, those poor people. That's all they had to say about the ATA.
Then
they were brave.
Really equipped with sea fires.
I kept on being pushed into having... Oh, yeah, the squadron was re-equipped with sea fires, but I didn't take it on. By that time, I think I had jumped a gap, but it doesn't matter, because I don't think anything frightfully interesting happened beyond that that needs recording. I was then... instructed to write Naval Air Tactical Memoranda, they called it, NATAMS. And this was the naval version of how to bomb, strafe, rocket, air defense, escort duties, top cover, everything to do with air fighting. And so I was given my own sea fire, which I based at Andover, and I was able, I had carte blanche to fly anywhere and do anything. So I'd have dinner in the Orkneys and have lunch next day down in Cornwall. It's really the only reward I got out of the war, really, was the fun of having my own CFAR, which enabled me to fly practically anywhere I wanted. And of course, I was really trying to get people's opinions about what I had written and so on. So finally, I finished writing all these books. And then they sent me, short-circuited me to go out to the Far East. I think that was in November 43. Have we got to November 43?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah. Well, 43, I had to fly out to the Far East. They decided that they were going to have a vast expansion. Churchill had always insisted that what was British in the Far East was still stay British. He was terrified that the Americans were going to walk all over Southeast Asia and also Hong Kong. So he was determined to get his foot in there. Ernie J. King, of course, was determined that there was going to be no goddamn foot in there by the Brits, because he's going to be a drawback. Anyway, so I got sent out with one or two other eminent people. I've left out one little bit, I know. Do you mind me harping back?
Yes, all right.
In that period of 1942, I did the wing leader's course at Charmy Down. It was a very exciting. This is where I met Duncan Smith, who was commanding officer of Charmy Down, and it was a wing leader's course. And I got a lovely photograph of some tremendously famous old sweats of all nationalities, Czechs and Danes, Norwegians, and so on. And we flew Spitfires endlessly for about 6 weeks. And as a result of that, I used to go and Peter Simpson, who was had a wing at Red Hill. I used to fly down to Red Hill, and I'd say, come on, give me one of your cabs. And we used to go over to France and play ramrods and escort duties over France. Right, well, the next thing I got was summons by the Admiralty to report for getting a special passport when I was described as a government official and told to report to Lynham for passage to Gibraltar. So I was to fly out to Gibraltar, actually from Barnstaple, where the aircraft took off, a chap called Captain Sherwood, who was an Imperial Airways pilot, in a C-47, the old Dakota. And we went out to about 20 degrees west. The interesting thing is that the old days, they used to fly at about 12 degrees west. And I said, why are we going so far out to sea? He said, well, last week, Leslie Howard was being flown out to Gib, and he went 10 degrees west. And the Ju-88 came in and shot him down. So I thought it would be interesting for at least someone who was well-known celebrity, in fact, a very fine actor, had been shot down the week before I took the same passage. Anyway, when I flew out, it was a filthy night, and I said to Captain Sherwood, I said, go on, put on your landing lights, and let's see what it looks like outside. So he did for about 5 seconds. It was just nothing, driving rain and horror. So there was no Ju-88s when I was out there. We had to land at Lisbon. And I never forget landing at Lisbon. Of course, in Lisbon, Portugal was neutral. And when we landed, we went into the aircraft buildings. And there was Lufthansa in an office. And I remember the sense of absolute horror looking at a big fat German with sort of wheels of flesh hanging down over his collar, thick neck, and looking at him almost as though I almost wanted to be sick looking at him. There at last was one of the enemy really close face to face. And I must say, a pretty distasteful moment it was. Then we went on to Gibraltar, quite simple. I then flew on to Tafarui or someplace. And my job was to instruct the formidable air group in wing tactics and escort duties and so on. Well, that was fun. That lasted for a bit. I nearly got killed by running into a wire. I allotted a motorbike, and there was a wire stretched across the road. I think it was one of those anti-terrorist devices. So I got upseated, but it didn't quite kill me. Anyway, once again, I got back to England in Battler with lots and lots of oranges and lemons, which I've already described as a passport to heaven.
So Tafarui is North Africa?
Oh, yes, North Africa. All this was conquered North Africa. Of course, Rommel had gone by then.
Can we go back to your going out to the Far East at the end of 1943,
please? Right, November 43, yes. Well, then at last lot, I flew out there. That was a great flying trip, too. All sorts of weird places. And I got to Colombo to Rear Admiral Naval Air Station's Indian Ocean. And my job really was to prepare the way for a vast increase in naval squadrons, which needed bases and fighter training equipment and so forth. So I sat on my bottom doing absolutely nothing for a couple of months. And then I flew up to Delhi to find out what was going on.
So this was supposed to be staff work?
I have a staff job. Staff fighter training officer I was. And I flew up to Delhi to see everything I asked for. Nobody answered my signals. Nobody gave me anything. I was just left there sweating it out in the gall face flush. And if you know what the gall face flush is, most old hands will tell you that the ration of spirits in Colombo was one bottle per officer per month. But if you went to the gall face, they had a daily issue of about 10 bottles, and first come, first serve. So everybody started queuing up. The bar opened at 6. I used to get there at 5, 10 to 6 with my friends, and originally we just ordered a couple of doubles. In the end, we got rather crafty and ordered about half a dozen doubles, and we all carted them to a chair, and we had a month's ration all drunk one evening. Such is life. And I had a chummery with a chap called Wing Commander Stone, a very famous Battle of Britain and a Battle of France chap who actually had withdrawn his squadron in the Burma campaign, in the awful retreat. And he'd done it with great distinction. And he was tremendous fun. He was fighter operations officer. So as a result, he had to have a jeep with him, so we had free transport everywhere he went. Anyway, lots of silly other things that don't matter about how he found out whether there was draft beer in the police station. All this was relieves the tedium of being under war conditions with all the lights still on, and yet none of the relaxations, so we had to provide our own. So life went on. I went up to Delhi, as I told you, to find out what was going on. And I was informed up there that the conference at Tehran had decided that the main concentration should be the invasion of Europe, and that all the forces... Blolo, this famous ship that I told you about in Algiers, by this time had arrived in Bombay. And landing craft ships and all those sort of things were all piling out there. When I got there, they all decided they all had to turn around and go.